Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and Carmen is down in Florida. Lucky duck. So, it's just me today, but I have two amazing guests that are joining us. And we are going to talk today a little bit about the Westward Movement and horticulture and the plants of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. So, we have two amazing guests with us from the Philadelphia Academy of Natural Sciences, Richard McCourt and Dr. Alfred Ernie. Is it Schuyler or Schuyler?
Schuyler.
Think of the sky. Okay, Schuyler, who's the curator emeritus. And we're going to talk about a subject that for me started back in third grade. I was lucky enough to learn my colonial history while living in Virginia. And if anyone has the chance to learn colonial history in Virginia, I say take them up on it because it is the best place. You're just steeped in history. And I remember my third grade class, and we were learning about the Westward Movement, and we had to do one of those topographical maps made out of flour and salt and water of the state of Virginia. And I got so excited, and it was large. It was on a board that was probably, I don't know, 3 feet by 2 feet. And I had to, you know, design and do the mountains and the water and, you know, paint it. And it was this whole huge thing. And I got so excited that I ended up doing every single state in the nation. And my parents knew that they had a historian on their hands when I started topographically sculpting the mountains and the landscape. So I became obsessed after that with Lewis and Clark. And today we're going to talk about Lewis and Clark. And I want to introduce my two guests. Richard McCourt's primary research is on the biodiversity, evolution, and ecology and systematics of green algae, and specifically a group known as charophyte algae. But
yeah, that's right.
Okay. He has also worked in historical botany and has published a number of papers on the Lewis and Clark Herbarium at the Academy. And he co-authored a book with Earl Spammer, which was a special publication in CD-ROM, on a short book on the Lewis and Clark Herbarium. And Dr. Alfred Ernie Schuyler is a historic American botanist, and he has specialized in systematics and the ecology of rare plant species. He's very interested in the relationship between plant diversity and environmental quality. He's also interested in the history of botanical exploration in North America, and he teaches at university, and he's on staff as well as Dr. McCourt at the Philadelphia Academy of Natural Sciences, which houses the Lewis and Clark collection. So, guys, let me just introduce this a little bit and say one of Thomas Jefferson really initiated this whole exploration, and his quote was, "The greatest service which can be rendered in any country is to add a useful plant to its culture." He was very, very interested in the West and what the West had to offer. And I will turn it over to you guys, and let's talk about Jefferson's directive and kind of the origin.
Okay.
Of the expedition.
Sure. Well, Meriwether Lewis was his personal secretary for a while, and so we knew about him a bit. And Lewis had a background in a little bit of background in botany, and that his mother was a botanist, and as a military man camping out, I'm sure he about plants and how to survive in the wild and things like that.
Dr. McCart, one technical thing. You're kind of cutting in and out. Are you on? Are you guys both on speaker?
Yeah, I'm on. You're on speaker. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's much better. Yep.
I hear a little bit of feedback. I'll turn the volume up just a little bit. Maybe I don't know if that's my volume or your volume, but I pressed the button for it.
Okay, let's try it now. Let's see how it goes.
I can hear you better, too.
Okay, good.
Okay. Well, Meriwether Lewis was Thomas Jefferson's secretary for a while, and so he had a good working relationship with him. He was probably known to him, and that's why he picked him to the expedition.
Uh-huh.
I'm hearing a little bit of feedback there, but I'll try to... the idea behind Lewis and Clark doing this is kind of similar to the way we used to treat astronauts in this country. Nowadays, they have PhDs in science, but back in the jet rocket days, you know, the first astronauts were fighter pilots and jet pilots more than they were scientists.
Uh-huh.
And that's Lewis Clark, really. He was a military man with some background in the natural world, but not a technical botanist, per se.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mission and things like that. So he was sent to Philadelphia by Jefferson to learn how to do botany collections,
mm-hmm.
and other natural history collections. And so he learned that from professors at University of Pennsylvania and other medical colleges around here.
Right.
And that's also why he came back to Philadelphia afterwards and gave the plants to a botanist at the University.
Right.
Benjamin Smith Barton.
Right. So actually, the birth of the expedition really started in Philadelphia, even though they physically left for the trail in St. Louis. But the ideology starts in Philadelphia, right? Because Philadelphia was really the bastion of art and culture, and it was kind of the think tank of the era and the age.
Right. Yeah, we still think of ourselves that way, actually.
Yeah.
but if you want to say it where it actually started, it might have started really at Monticello, where Jefferson launched it. But intellectually speaking, this was where Lewis got a lot of his training for the various things he would make observations on.
Right.
Ethnography to botany.
Mm-hmm.
And he also picked up a lot of supplies here as well before he went on to west to through Pittsburgh and St. Louis and then off to the wilder parts of the United States, or the territory.
Right, and plant collecting was not a hobby at the time. It was really big business. It was, as you say in your text that you sent me, it was fanning the flames of competition in science and commerce.
Yeah, we collect plants nowadays scientifically. There are also a fair number of plants being collected for medicinal and commercial purposes. Well, but back in that era, there were a lot of unknown species, more
mm-hmm.
than now, obviously.
Right.
And plant collecting was, I wouldn't say it's a competitive game, but it seems in some ways like they almost viewed them as trading cards. You know, they would want to discover that new species and collect someplace that's never been collected before.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States at the time, at the territory of Louisiana Purchase and the Far West, was pretty much unknown for plants until you got out to the West Coast where some boats and ships had landed before.
Right.
But between here and there was pretty much terra incognita. And so Jefferson thought there might be some useful plants, and he wanted Lewis to discover them and bring some specimens back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you were saying that Meriwether Lewis was more of a military man. His mother was actually an herbalist, so he did have some training, although elementary, with plants, but he also he really needed to learn, as you said, the process. So he worked very closely with John Bartram and William Bartram, and he kind of studied those books very closely, right? And he had to learn how to press the flowers and...
He did have to learn that. Actually, he didn't know John Bartram, who was gone by that time, right, Ernie? He was dead, but William Bartram might have been around, but we don't actually have a record of him meeting him. But Bartram's garden did exist, and there's a confusion of names. He was trained by Benjamin Smith Barton, who is a medicinal botany professor at the University of Pennsylvania, or PENN as we call it. And so he learned how to press plants from him, and he doesn't really describe it, but he did a good job of pressing the plants, we know from the specimens that came back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we infer that he got good training in it and brought them back in pretty decent shape, the ones that made it back.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the plants that he actually brought back. One of the first and most interesting for me is the Osage orange. And the reason I have a personal story with the Osage orange, not only is it one of the first seeds that he sent back while on his trip, but it's also the tree in which my husband and I met under in Prospect Park here in Brooklyn. The Osage orange, I have a little blurb about it, and I'll do a little explanation. It's a tree species native to the southern Mississippi Valley. It might have been the most significant horticultural discovery of the expedition. Meriwether Lewis sent some slips of the Osage plums and apples to Jefferson in March of 1804 from a garden in St. Louis owned by Pierre Chouteau. On his return journey in 1807, Lewis collected seeds from the same but the more mature specimen, finally bearing seeds after three vegetative seasons, and personally brought them back to Washington and Philadelphia. These were distributed to Philadelphia nurseryman Bernard McMahon and wealthy plantsman William Hamilton, and were successfully grown and distributed. The 17th century French explorers described the tree as bois d'or, or bowwood, which is a term later corrupted by the Americans to bodark. Native American Indians exploited the exceptional strength and elasticity of the wood for tomahawks and especially bows. One Osage bow was worth a horse and blanket in trade. The convoluted grapefruit-sized fruit of the female trees, formidable thorns on young shoots, yellow-colored bark, and lush, healthy foliage distinguishes this trait. Robert Carr, proprietor of Bartram's Garden in Philadelphia, was one of the tree's first commercial sources in 1828, but by the mid-19th century, it became the most commonly planted plant in America. Osage orange can be sheared effectively into impenetrable hedges, and 60,000 miles of bodark hedging were reportedly planted in 1868 alone. The invention of barbed wire soon made Osage orange hedges less desirable. So I love that, all that theory. And I have been to the Osage orange tree that's planted in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh, in the churchyard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's huge.
St. Peter's Church. There's several of them there, actually. They're growing over some of the graves and disturbing the headstones and so forth like that.
Yeah.
Ernie, do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I think those are from, originally came from seeds of man, although there might be more than one place. Man's garden, too.
Ernie,
garden at near Second and Market, near Christchurch, also has some flora trees.
Ernie, could I ask you to speak? Could I ask you to speak closer to the microphone of the phone, please?
How am I doing now?
Yeah, that's great.
Is that better?
Perfect.
Oh, hello? Is that better?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so I also think that there were trees at Second and Market near Christchurch, the location of Bernard McMahon's nursery or his garden. And so I've never been quite sure which was the primary site for the trees in Philadelphia, there or St. Peter's. At any rate, they were grown here, they were circulated, and even today, when I walk along fence rows, Chester County or Buffalo County, I can always count on seeing a Maclura. They still persist as a fence row tree.
Yeah.
And also an ornamental in various parks.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you see them? I haven't seen them much in commerce as a garden designer, but it's a plant that I'm going to do a little more research on because it sounds like it would make a great hedge really, really tough.
And I think that was what was done primarily with it.
Yeah.
But I do think, as a tree, it's a handsome ornamental. We have some very large trees in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And I always like when I see them.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I met my husband under the one that's planted in Prospect Park, and I'm going to have to call up my friends over in the park there and ask if when they got the seed and if that tree is one of the Bernard McMahon seeds.
Yeah. At any rate, there's another story that I like, and I'm not sure I got it quite right. Why was Maclura a rare plant? And we think that was because the animals that distributed it no longer existed. It might have been a bison or maybe even a sloth. But in Texas now, it's spreading very well on horse farms because horses.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now, of course, it's not really a rare plant because of where we've planted it.
Right.
And it does occasionally spread into the wild. We see it on occasion in Fairmount Park here in Philadelphia.
And I know that also the Osage Orange is a good insect repellent. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Maybe I should do something about it.
Yeah.
Mosquitoes love me.
No, it's supposed to be great, actually, for cockroaches. I actually cut several up. I took them home from the park and, you know, kind of squirted them around. I squeezed the juice and kind of squirted it. I don't know if it did any good, but it felt fun to, you know, to think about that as an attribute.
Well, if it would keep away Japanese beetles, I'd be interested in that.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the journals. And I know he was trained very well, Meriwether Lewis, in descriptions of the plant parts and identification and in the setting and where each plant occurred in the natural environment. But at times, there was some criticism of some of the plant notes. Is that right?
I don't recall any criticism of the plant notes.
Oh, there was
kind of unknown for quite a while.
Are you talking about Lewis's notes?
Lewis's notes, yeah. There was a reference, Mr. McCourt, in your attachment about that some people were sort of negative that there wasn't enough information. But then other people were saying like the information was amazing and that didn't that lead to your work, Ernie, with being able to pinpoint some of the plants and the collections?
They were, for pinpointing the location in the collections?
Or where they were collected.
Where
they were collected, yeah.
Where they were collected. Well, you know, between the data on the labels in the herbarium specimens,
mm-hmm.
and his notebooks, we can pinpoint very precisely the location of almost every collection he made.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes this herbarium, or the Lewis collections, very special, because this is pre-Darwinian.
Right.
And people didn't really, all they wanted was a specimen, and they didn't particularly care about knowing variation in plants. So many times our labels of Western American plants back in those days would simply say Rocky Mountains. They might say Missouri River.
Right.
With no other data.
Mm-hmm.
But now we can go to Lewis's collections and pinpoint very precisely, at least within a few miles, where he got the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick can probably tell you more about
how a climate person used the could therefore come here, take fragments of these plants, and determine CO2 content of the atmosphere in northern South Dakota in 1804. A use of Lewis's collections that never would have occurred to me otherwise.
Right.
Right, exactly.
There's a number of sources of information. You have the labels on the plants, some of which are by Lewis and some of which are transcribed by Frederick Kirsch, a botanist who helped him out with it. And then you have the detailed journals of Lewis and also those of Clark, who was really the cartographer.
Mm-hmm.
So he was mapping things out, and Lewis was making some comments in the journals. Some of his label information was kind of cursory, but that's often the case for labels. You make notes in a notebook because there's not enough room to write on the label.
Yes.
So he combining all those sources together, you can pinpoint pretty closely to where they were. And Gary Moulton, who's edited all the journals and worked with Ernie and us here about the plant collection, has helped to really pinpoint where things were.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the dates are actually maybe a year off just by a typo. What we call a typo today was a handwritten typo.
Right.
There's an occasional error like that, but you know where it is because they couldn't have been there on that particular date, and the journals would tell you where they really are. So that all puts together and gives a better picture of things. And, as Ernie said, once the plant dies, aside from some natural degradation and maybe off-gassing of certain chemicals, it kind of sits as a permanent record of sampling from the air, like carbon dioxide and sometimes other materials from the atmosphere and also the soil, that becomes part of the plant. And you can do some analyses to detect differences in chemistry between plants. And that's been done a little bit, but unfortunately you have to destroy a tiny piece of the plant. So we've only sampled the specimens with scientists who really know what they're doing on this in biogeochemistry,
uh-huh.
and also with plant specimens that had an abundance of leaves on them. So if we took a small half a postage stamp of a leaf and ground it up and used it in chemical tests, it didn't do any real damage to the specimen.
Mm-hmm. And have you been able to determine any species that no longer exist?
No, there's none that are extinct as far
okay.
as we can tell.
Good.
And which means, you know, the species are still out there. Jim Reveal, who died recently, was an authority on the field biology of these things. And he actually made one interesting discovery. It was thought that a tobacco variety that the Arikara tribe gave to Lewis had
mm-hmm.
gone extinct. It was probably actually just kept and cultivated secretly by the Native Americans. They have a relationship with plants that is in some cases sacred, or at least more private than we would think of as being a farmer.
Right.
And that was thought to be extinct for a while. And Jim Reveal was in a national park in North Dakota. Is that right, Ernie?
Fort Lincoln,
North Dakota. And he saw growing in the garden of the headquarters or the building there the supposedly extinct variety of tobacco. And, of course, Jim is one of the few people in the world who would actually look at it and in 5 seconds figure out what it was. He found out that it had been given to one of the rangers by a Native American and apparently maintained for that long. So that's no longer thought to be extinct either, although it's not widely known from nature.
Right. Are you talking about the Nicotiana quadrivalis?
Quadrivalis, yes. That
okay.
one.
Yeah. I was reading about that in Jefferson's journal, The Twin Leaf, that's put out by Monticello. And...
Wow.
And I guess Jefferson really did not like tobacco. He said it was a productive of infinite wretchedness. he really was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
he didn't like to use it, but Ernie says he grew it.
Yeah. He described.
He did live in Virginia, after all.
That's right. He described the Mandan tobacco as a singular species, uncommonly weak and probably suitable for cigars. So
here's what Lewis said
uh-huh.
when he stopped and smoked it,
uh-huh.
the Arikaras. He said, pretty good smoke.
And I also love, I was very taken with Echinacea angustifolia as opposed to the purpurea, which is the one that we use both in garden design, but the angustifolia is described as the mad dog plant, which is the coneflower, and it was highly prized by the natives as an efficacious remedy in the cure of the bite of the rattlesnake or the mad dog. And it's the narrow-leafed plains coneflower, which was not technically described until 1836. So this coneflower differs from the more commonly cultivated Echinacea purpurea because of its reflexed purple flowers in the taproot, making it somewhat more difficult to transplant, but just as heat and drought resistance. So do you know anything about what was said about that in Lewis's journals?
I have to do homework. You know more than I do right now.
Well, I did.
I can't recall anything about that specifically.
Okay. And then also the acari bean. That was a pretty important plant, I think. That was also one of the early commercial selections, or it was one of the commercial plants that went into commerce. And that was that really kept Lewis alive. I think that was a pretty important bean. Right?
I think yes, but I think there were Indians grew this bean, Phaseolus vulgaris, but I think each tribe probably had a distinct cultivar.
Right.
So the Arecora kidney bean was grown by Jefferson, but I don't think it ever went anywhere beyond that.
Yeah.
There are many sources for kidney beans, and I don't think he was too satisfied with what he had, nor did he go anywhere with a Arecora corn.
Mm-hmm.
He did grow it at Monticello, but these were sort of agricultural dead ends, as far as I could tell. You may find something that says otherwise, but I doubt it.
Yeah, and Stephen Ambrose, in his book about the Lewis and Clark expedition, said that it was Mandan corn that got the men through the winter. So I think that was a pretty important, discovery. Here's a little excerpt that I read. As the expedition traveled north along the Missouri River in the fall of 1805, they encountered the Mandan Acara. How do you pronounce it?
The Arecora.
Arecora.
The Arecora were south of the Mandans. Yeah, he had Mandan corn and also Arecora corn.
Yeah, and he said their horticulture, based on the cultivation of bean, corn, and squash varieties that thrived in the severe climate of the northern plains, was perhaps the most evolved of all Northern American Indian tribes. And this is these are actually also this is the land that George Catlin was painting in the 1830s. So if anybody's an art historian out there that's listening. So this would be the territory that's north of Bismarck.
Yes.
And then I was also fascinated with the Mandan Gardens. And I'd like to read a little bit about these because this is a really interesting procedure of garden making. The Mandan Gardens were along the river bottoms, and they averaged about a quarter acre in size, and they were cared for by the women. Gardens would often be moved after exhausting soil, and they were seldom cultivated. It was considered a violation to plow or to dig up the earth. Garden debris was grazed by horses in fall and then raked away in spring for planting. Animal manure was considered unclean. Tools came from animal parts. Deer antlers were used as rakes and bison bones as hoes. Half of their subsistence and economy was based on cultivated vegetable varieties that had been developed for the cold weather, short season, meaning 90 days, and limited rainfall, 10 inches a year. As early as 1729, Mandan villages held harvest-time markets for both European and Indian bartering, attracting consumers from as far away as the Great Lakes and the Rocky Mountains. So that is phenomenal that there was that trade going on as early as 1729. And I love the early garden practices that were described. That in itself is worth the whole expedition, I think.
Well, you see, you're talking to a guy here who kills plants. But I think you're on target there. The Arikaras were very, and the Mandans, were very good farmers.
Uh-huh.
In contrast, the Sioux were very good hunters,
mm-hmm.
and some of the other tribes. So there was a trade-off there between hunting and farming, and the Arikaras and Mandans took the latter.
Uh-huh. I would like you to describe and explain to me the camas plant, C-A-M-A-S. There's a little excerpt here that I found really fascinating. For example, when the Corps of Discovery clambered down the western slopes of the Lolo Trail, they were nearly starved. They had eaten several of their horses because they had no other food. The Nez Perce Indians that had encountered them taught them how to steam the roots of the cama plant, C-A-M-A-S. Can you tell me a little bit about that plant?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite plants, and it covers, you get into a place, flats where they grow, and when you see it, these habitats from a distance, because of the blue color of the flowers, you think you're looking at a lake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that became a very important plant. The roots or the bulbs were consumed because they didn't have much else to eat except salmon. But my favorite story about camas has to do with beer.
Oh.
Have you heard that one?
No, do tell.
Well, this guy Collins, who was a troublemaker on much of the expedition. In fact, he'd been court-martialed once. Now, they made some camas bread, and they put it in their canoes. And just before they entered the Columbia Gorge, Collins took some wet camas bread, and I don't know how he did it, and he brewed beer.
Uh-huh.
And he immediately became a hero because all the alcohol by that time was consumed.
Right.
And you know how important alcohol can be on with a group like that. At least
sure.
It would be very important to me.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Well, unfortunately, we have to take a break right now. Stay on the line. We're going to have a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back in a few minutes to talk more about the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about the Lewis and Clark Trail, and we've got two amazing authors and academic and representatives with us. We have Richard McCourt and Dr. Alfred Ernie Schuyler, Curator Emeritus of the Philadelphia Academy of Natural Sciences. So, guys, when we were just talking about beer and we were talking about the trip, and can you tell us a little bit, do you have any more kind of anecdotal stories of what the trip was like?
Well, it wasn't all fun and games, that's for sure.
No.
They did have some pretty difficult times. In terms of the plants, they actually buried a cache of plants on the way out, and intending to bring them, pick them up on the way back, because it's easier to bury them and protect them that way than to carry them all the time.
Yeah.
And they came back, the river had flooded, and so they luckily, it was still within a time period that they could, you know, encountering the cache site on the way back, they knew what they had lost to some extent. And so they could recollect a bit of what they might have lost. But we don't know exactly what was lost in that. But it could have been a fair number of plants that they collected on the way out. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
However, they still came back with about 220-some specimens of plants.
Yeah, so let's... I can elaborate a little more on that.
They had two caches. They had one near Great Falls, and they had another one near the when they crossed from Montana into Idaho, when they crossed the Continental Divide. And we have seeds of that Lewis saved, and so we now have specimens that were lost when the second cache was more or less wiped out. They made one critical mistake with both caches. They put them next to a place near a river or a tributary of a river where they would be flooded.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good idea if you want to come back and find something left behind. So we know a little bit more about that second cache, but we also know that there were specimens that were probably took from that cache that weren't very good and probably taken by Persch to England where he studied them. One of the plants he described was one of my favorites, Mimulus lewisii, Lewis's monkey flower,
mm-hmm.
and Persch published a drawing of it, but there's no specimen. There were other plants that Persch described, and we're sure he had a specimen fragment. So we do have some information about what was in that second cache, but as Rick indicated, the first cache would have held all the plants that he collected between Fort Mandan and what is now Great Falls, Montana, and there must have been a lot of things there that disappeared.
Right, and then even, I think, the collection kind of got a little fractured even after the expedition, right? When it came back to Philadelphia, it was kind of broken up into different
right.
segments. Can you talk a little bit about that? And part of it went to London?
Yeah.
And
yeah, the when they brought the collection back, we think Lewis showed it to Thomas Jefferson, probably, and then came to Philadelphia with it. And he, although he had described some items, many of the plants in his journals using the technical botanical nomenclature that was in the books he took along,
mm-hmm.
he was not really prepared himself to write it up as a monograph,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way a botanist would.
Right.
He gave it to Benjamin Smith Barton, his original mentor, but Barton was distracted or too busy with other things, and so he handed them off to Frederick Persch, a German who liked beer a lot, coming back around to that. Yeah, and unfortunately did die of alcoholism much later in Montreal. But he was a gardener for William Hamilton, who owned a very magnificent estate in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
It still exists as a building on a cemetery now. It's been restored to be a little bit of a monument, preserved house. But Persch, although he was a working person, he had to do this for a living, was technically a good botanist. And so he worked up the plants. He transcribed Lewis's notes. From what he wrote in his book about this, it seems like he must have interviewed Lewis about some of these things. I don't know if he would have seen the journals because they were, handwritten and they were going somewhere else. But they were not published as a technical journal until, without everything in it, for at least 100 years. And so Persch's publication, which was a two-volume Flora of North America,
mm-hmm.
published in 1813, was the only way people knew about the plants of Lewis and Clark for the first 100 years. Otherwise, they would probably just be a footnote to history that they were collected at one time. We may or may not have preserved them. But they would have been described by later explorers who went west of the Mississippi and the Missouri to do other explorations. But as it was, because of Persch, Lewis got some credit for this.
Okay. And
now,
then
when he brought them back, though, Persch worked them up, and then he gave most of them, about three-fourths of them, back to the American Philosophical Society.
Right.
We gave them back to Barton, who died, and then they went to the American Philosophical Society. Persch kept some with him, though, and without anybody's permission, He took him to London, where he went and worked for a while with the support of Elmer Burke Lambert, a rich gentleman who had a large herbarium of some 50,000 to 60,000 specimens.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked on them there, and Peirce then returned to the United States, didn't bring the plants with him, left them with Lambert. And when Lambert died, they were, luckily enough, purchased at an auction of his materials and items by a young American named Edward Tuckerman.
Right.
Yeah. And he was a lichenologist. He was a young man at the time, making a tour of Europe, and he was doing some botanical work in London. He was a botanist at the time still. But he bought two boxes of American plants. And, of course, Lewis and Clark were not celebrities at this time. It was 1854. Maybe they were known, but not the celebrity we have today.
Right.
And so he wouldn't have necessarily bid higher for Lewis and Clark's plants, but they were North American plants, and they had some very interesting collections in them, not just of Lewis and Clark, but other early collectors.
Mm-hmm.
He brought them back, kept them at Amherst for a while, and eventually decided that they would get better care over the long term at the Academy of Natural Sciences. So he sent them to the Academy in, what was it, 18? Was that 1850?
I think around 1856.
So it was a little while after he got them into London, but he brought them back and then deposited them here.
Right.
Meanwhile, the other three-fourths of the plants were probably wrapped up in packages that Peirce left them in, and in a cupboard or someplace over at the American Philosophical Society, which is a real scholarly library here and museum now.
Mm-hmm. And that was founded by Ben Franklin, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was.
And John Bartram.
And John Bartram, right.
He should get credit for that almost equally
as
Benjamin Franklin.
And wasn't Hamilton's house very near to the Bartram estate, right?
Not very far. It was on the Schuylkill River, and as the crow flies, it wasn't very far. Today it's a little subway right-of-way.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's such a fascinating topic, and Ernie, I know you've actually, done a lot of kind of futuristic work analyzing the survivability of these plants and how they're doing, and what's next, right? What's next for the collection?
And what I'm doing right now is looking at plants that Henry Muhlenberg grew in his garden in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Henry got six seeds of six species given to him by Meriwether Lewis, and he successfully grew them. And far as I can tell, most people are unaware of these plants that Muhlenberg grew. And Muhlenberg also was able to get plants out of McMahon's garden. I think McMahon regarded him as a pest, but eventually he relinquished and let Muhlenberg in his garden. Now, see, Muhlenberg was more like me. He killed plants, but so he pressed these plants and preserved them for his herbarium. But unlike me, he was also a pretty good gardener. So he grew plants from Lewis's seeds, pressed them, and we can see them in his herbarium today.
Yeah.
And I think that's something of interest. I guess that pretty much says something as far as I'm concerned about where my future with the collection is going, but there certainly must be something grabbing the attention of others.
Well, what I think should happen from a gardener's perspective is I think we need to make a collection of these plants and get them out into commerce as the Lewis and Clark collection. I think it would be great to see an example of all of these plants together in a garden somewhere. So maybe we could work on that.
That would be a fascinating thing to do. Jim Reveal, the late friend of ours I mentioned, we applied to National Geographic to go recollect the plants of Lewis and Clark. We didn't get funding for it, but Jim collected quite a few of these. He's written about them extensively in a couple of books.
Uh-huh.
So it would be interesting to do that. Of course, they wouldn't all grow in the same climate. Some are
no, but we could,
very,
you know,
But you could figure it out. We recreated Traveler's Rest. I say we. It was mostly Ernie and some other folks who collected plants from out west at Traveler's Rest, which is just outside near Montana, Idaho border. And we had a little waterfall and a number of plant specimens there. We had them growing for the Philadelphia Flower Show, which is next week.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and they're celebrating the national parks, but I don't know if they're going to have Lewis and Clark plants per se.
Yeah.
They probably will have some planted, though. But I still have a specimen of berberis, which is the state flower of Oregon, that we grew in that exhibit. When was that, Ernie? 2003?
No, it was 1998.
And I still have it growing in my backyard.
So well, we use that berberis.
Well, in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we actually use that berberis all the time here in New York. And actually, Lewis wrote, I'll just end with this note. Lewis wrote, "It is an evergreen plant which grows in an open plains. Usually the natives smoke its leaves and they mix it with tobacco." So we'll end on that note. Beer and tobacco.
Oh, yeah. That's the bearberry, I think. He's talking about that. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's right.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Unfortunately, our time is up, but I'm really appreciative of all the information you shared with our listeners. And is there a way that a layman can walk in and see the journals and see the herbarium at all?
On special occasions, we have some exhibits. We don't want to expose them to the vicissitudes of handling for very much. But occasionally, we do give tours, but it's kind of by special arrangement.
Right.
We don't have the journals. They're at the American Philosophical Society. They're even harder to get to than the plant specimens because they're probably even more fragile in the way that you have to open them to see them and things like that.
Yeah.
So they're hard to get to, and the American Philosophical Society will occasionally show them. They put out a limited edition of a few of the journals that are facsimiles. They look like the original journals, but they're on paper. I don't know if they're being sold, though. I think that they didn't. They only kept it to a limited printing, unfortunately.
Right.
So you have to look at the journals as edited by Gary Moulton. Recently, and other people as well. There's a website that Jim Reveal has online. His name is Reveal, R-E-V-E-A-L, and he has pictures of the plants from nature with a number of notes about them. And he also published a book by himself and Scott Earle called Lewis and Clark's Green World. So you can see things in there. But seeing the original plants, it takes it's only a few times a year at the most. And kind of by special arrangement.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for all of your work. And you've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Join us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. And we'll see you in the virtual garden. Thanks so much.
RadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.